So, this morning, I want to talk about faith, because I think it's a very complicated idea, and it is actually a very important idea within the Buddhist tradition. Most people don't associate Dharma practice with faith, but it's certainly there, and it tops many of the important lists. But first, I want to talk about something that's going to sound very huge and academic, but it's not. And it's called soteriological polarity. I don't know if you've come across this term, soteriological polarity, but I'll tell you what it is. It's not as complicated as it sounds. So the word soteriology is an academic word, and people who study soteriology, it's the study of salvation. So people who study ideas of human salvation, be it religious, spiritual, whatever, there's lots of different things that fit in the study of soteriology. And so it's really just how do human beings become liberated? What is the nature? What is the path? What is the role of salvation within the human context? And it's obviously a very important idea that goes back probably to the dawn of man. Now, polarity, of course, we all know what that is. So soteriological polarity puts us in this really difficult place. So on one hand, we could say that most soteriology goes with the thinking of there being some kind of external, let's say, God figure that is going to provide you with a salvation. So a lot of these ideas have been externalized. I need to believe in an external force, and this external force, whatever you want to call it, is going to provide me with a kind of eternal, happily ever after heaven kind of salvific dogma. And that's kind of generally how that has gone. Now, Buddhism or Dharma practice in here often gets confused where it's more likely saying that the Buddha is saying, actually, no, that's not what's going to happen. And what you need to do is you need to, everything that you need is already inside of you, and actually that you shouldn't seek any external salvation. You should actually do the hard work of training your mind and training your heart and finding a salvation here and now in this present moment experience, and that everything that you need is actually right here in this moment, in this mind, in this body, and we want to develop that. Now, probably many of you, if you're on the screen here today, have erred on the side of maybe that thinking. But I also know some of you have other faiths as well, so it can be really kind of confusing on how we manage this. I also think it's really important how we go about this. But I will say, on a moment-to-moment level, if we kind of just look at moment-to-moment experience, even I, my tendency is to believe that everything is inside of me, and I don't really have an idea of an eternal kind of salvation experience. That's not been part of my thinking. But as much as I say that, I'll tell you what, on any given day, I'm constantly externalizing my salvation. And it usually starts in the phrase, I'll be happy when. I don't know if you're familiar with this, I'll be happy when. So as much as I maybe believe or buy into this dharmic soteriology of like everything I need is inside of me and there's nothing out there that's going to provide lasting satisfaction, I'm always looking for it. You know, and I'm always, you know, reaching for and grasping and trying to figure out, you know, when I have this amount of money in the bank, I'll be happy. When I get this amount of my yard finished, I'll be happy. When my children behave properly, I'll be happy. When I, you know, and all of these things, when I lose 30 pounds, I'll be happy. It's like, I could go on and on and on about the things that would make me happy. And of course, we know that suffering is born out of this idea in the moment that I'll be happy when, and that there's nothing available right now that I want. I don't want any of this moment experience. I'm wanting something else that's not being offered in this moment. And then I feel disappointed. I feel aggravated. I feel stressed. I suffer. And so you're probably very, very familiar with this. So even in our own subjective reality, we suffer from a soteriological polarity. Because we might believe, we might have a belief system that says, I don't need to do that, but I'm constantly not participating in my own view. And you can probably see this play out in your experience all the time. And then we kind of look at what's really confusing is So let's talk about the self for a minute, because y'all know I'm not a big fan of this anatta teaching, and I'll tell you why. The Buddha actually wouldn't make a claim. There's several passages in the canon. Well, somebody comes to see Gautama, they sit down. That's sort of how it goes. It's like somebody sits down, they bow three times, and they ask him a question. It's like all the time in the canon. And a couple times, they go to him and they say, well, tell us, Gautama, is there a self or is there not a self? And most of the time, he actually remains silent and won't even give an answer. And it will usually say whoever came to see him scurries off angrily disappointed. And usually Ananda, the Buddha's attendant who's with him, is always like, why didn't you answer his question? You know, he's all pissed off. The guy came to see you. You wouldn't even say a word. And the Buddha would say, I do not make these kinds of claims, because if I say there's a self, then I'm aligning with the eternalists. If I say there's a not self, then I'm aligning with the nihilists. And he says, I don't do that. I teach a middle way. I teach a middle way between eternalism and nihilism. So again, even the Buddha does not reject this external God out there salvation. He doesn't deny it. He says, I'm not actually interested in either of those conversations. I'm just not interested, because they're not going to be helpful. So then where do we go to from there? And this becomes a really important question. So when he says not self, all he's saying is everything that you think you are, you're not. That's all he's saying. He doesn't say that there's a not self either. He won't even actually talk about it. And there's a lot of things he won't talk about, because he says that he doesn't want to subscribe. Gautama never subscribes to black and white thinking. And anytime he's confronted with a black and white question or a black and white idea, he mostly doesn't say a word. And when he's asked why he didn't say anything, he always says the same thing. Because if I said yes, I would have been with these people. And if I said no, I would have been with these people. And I do not teach a path of eternalism and nihilism. And so I teach a path of verified faith. So now we talk about faith. So what do we have faith in? So if the faith isn't out there, and if it's not in here, where's the middle between those two? So the Pali term, I want to read this. It comes out of the Abhidharma. This is the best definition of faith, which in the Pali is sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A. And actually in the Buddhist psychology, Abhidharma kind of manual of thinking about experience, there's what's called the universal beautiful mental factors, in which there's 26 mental factors that the Buddha has outlined are beautiful mental factors that need to be recognized, developed, and cultivated. And so that's kind of what we're doing in our practice. And the first one is faith, and the second one is mindfulness. No faith, no mindfulness. So he says that faith is the first of the beautiful mental factors. Faith has the characteristic of placing faith or trusting. So it's a placement of attention. It's a placement. One of the definitions of faith is finding a trustworthy, where can I place my heart that's trustworthy? So it's not about belief, which is when we think of faith, we usually think of belief. I believe in this idea, and that's what I have faith in. Mostly we have faith in ideas, which is tragically unhelpful. So trustworthy is actually the word that the Abhidharma uses. Its function is to clarify, as a water-cleaning gem causes muddy water to become clear. Or its function is to set forth, as one might set forth to cross a flood. So again, it's characterized by a clearness, a very clearness, and also by a setting forth, an entering of a kind of journey. It is manifested as non-fogginess in the removal of the mind's impurities. Its proximate cause, so what causes it, is having something to place faith in, or hearing of the good Dhamma, which constitutes the factors of stream entry. So, obviously we want to have faith, and the Dhamma here is sort of the idea. Well, what is that, right? That's just not a one thing. So it's really kind of about trustworthiness. I think it's probably the best English term that does the heavy lifting. And how often do you put your faith, or you put your confidence, or actually I would even use the word attention. How often do you put your attention in something that's totally untrustworthy? Right? And if you track your mind moment to moment, day to day, this is our problem. I put my trust, I put my attention in something that is inherently untrustworthy. Right? Like concepts. Ajahn Sumedho, conceptualization is untrustworthy. You should not trust concepts. Right? And then you're like, well shit, what else do I got? But we do. We do this. And it's really, really problematic. So on a moment-to-moment experience, this is why so much of this work is about embodiment and about finding something that you have deemed or that you've understand or that you've corroborated through your own experience that's trustworthy. The other problem with faith from a Buddhist perspective is because of impermanence and a whole bunch of things, you can't have it all the time. You can't just be in faith and inspired all of the time, right? And so what do you do then? Or what do you do when you're in the... And so the opposite of faith, we could say, would be doubt. And the Buddha clearly says that doubt is the most destructive force in the mind. So if the opposite of the most destructive force in the mind is faith and trust, probably a good idea to try to cultivate or get a sense of how that works. So what do we do when we're in the doubt, when we're in the boredom, when we're in the confusion? One of the most important things to do that people don't often do is a practice called wise reflection, another practice that my friend Eve Ekman calls retrospective awareness, which I like better, which is actually remembering a time and a place when you did have it. Be like, I haven't always been full of doubt. So actually here, using your memories, using your life's direct experience to go back to a time and a place when you really actually felt it. Which we oftentimes know in our classic mindfulness teachings, you're supposed to stay out of the past. But actually not really so much the case. Here we can really use our direct past experience in a moment where we don't feel like we have it, where we feel so untrusting. And a lot of the things that gets us, what really gets us, I find, is that when I place my attention or my trust in something external and then it doesn't follow through, it doesn't pan out, it turns out to not have been such a great idea, it turns out to have been to have changed, and then where do you go? So when we're dealing with our own, you know, kind of trust polarity or soteriological polarity, whatever word you want to use, this is something you kind of have to navigate on the regular. This is something that's always going to be kind of lurking about in the mind somewhere. And probably many of you, ironically, that many of you who work with me have found that you've placed a lot of trust in your own cognitive conceptual abilities, right? And, you know, that's always so great. And it's such a bummer when you actually have to deal with the reality that that's sort of the case, because they do serve us well. So when we look at, what is the middle way between, you know, nihilism or eternalism, or where in this kind of field do we find what is trustworthy? And what is trustworthy is known as upaya. What's trustworthy from the Buddhist perspective is skillful means. You guys probably hear this term a lot in the Theravada insight world. What is skillful? So the Buddha is not interested in what's right and what's wrong. He's actually only interested in what works. What works? This is like Joseph Goldstein preached this for decades. What works to liberate the mind? What actually works? What works to liberate the mind on a big continuum? And what works for you to liberate the mind on a moment-to-moment experience? And your job is to find that out. And of course, as you know, there's not all just a one thing that you can go to all the time. Of course, everybody thinks mindfulness is just sort of, just be mindful and every bad thing in the universe will vanish, you know? So we have to have a repertoire of skillful means. And so that means we, that's trustworthy. Practices, skillful means, that is the only thing that we find here that's trustworthy, is what we can do by our own labor to actually liberate ourselves. So again, it's in the middle. Now, of course, we know the concept of that. Like, so maybe we could use metta as an example. Well, metta's trustworthy, right? Okay, cool. Well, so if you believe that that is trustworthy conceptually, is that going to help you when you need it? Probably not. So that's why we have to practice. So this is why Dharma is all really practice. And the reason I say this is always a plug for more practice. Because a lot of us, we believe everything that's being said here, but we don't practice. Because we don't practice because we believe in practice. Well, I believe that practice works. I'm not going to do it, but I totally believe it's good. I totally believe sitting every day for half an hour is good. I mean, I'm not going to do it, but I believe in it. And then we just become everything that we try to get away from. Believing in Dharma practices as an externalized thing, having belief in that, will do you maybe no good at all. In fact, it might even cause some problems. So when we back this up, the other thing to think about here, I think that's good before we do some practice, is you all familiar with this term sila, which is, you know, as I'm a big kind of sila Nazi, if you will. You know, it's a hard word to translate. So it usually gets translated as morality, which is not good, or ethics, which actually isn't so good, integrity, which feels better to me. But actually, there's a couple traditions. Interestingly enough, the Tibetan tradition, which you know I'm not a huge fan of, they translate sila as discipline, which I think actually is really good. I think it actually does the heavy lifting here. So when we think about what discipline is, what kind of a discipline do I have in response to my own sense of integrity? So we all have our own values. We all have a value system about things that we think are important, honesty and awareness or flexibility or kindness or compassion. There's all these kind of Buddhist values, right? But it's good to have values. But then the question becomes, well, what kind of a discipline do I have on the regular that actually is proof and evidence that I actually not only believe in these values, but I embody these values? I think that kindness is valuable, and it's an integrity that I take very seriously, and I practice actually pretty well. Always can't do it. Can't always do it. In fact, probably throughout the week, there's probably usually almost every week, there's usually four or five times where I'm actually fairly unkind, whether it's to myself or to others. It's not easy. And that's just, you know, that's just the level of my training. That's my skill set. And of course, there's a whole bunch of them. There's all the Brahmavihara practices. There's all the mindfulness practices. There's generosity practices. So when we think about what's trustworthy is actually our own commitment and our own discipline to what we truly value. And that's work. That's effort. You know, that's the teachings on right effort. The Buddha spoke more about right effort than he did anything else, because at the end of the day, without a doubt, all of this that we're doing, it's just work. And I don't always want to work. You know, there's the Buddha is not a big fan of laziness. You know, he says, you know, the lazy mind, when the mind is not engaged, when the mind wanders about on its own, it creates unhappiness. And even Richard Davidson says this. This comes from his neuroplasticity and, you know, neuroscience research. A wandering mind is an unhappy mind. A mind that just wanders out, you know, you let it off its leash and it doesn't go anywhere good on its own. But some of us who have done some practice and have done some discipline, this is where this is what I want to end with before I do it. This has been my big issue and my big problem is because I've done a decent amount of training and I've cleaned up a lot of my behavior, my mind wanders, but it's not that bad. Like, I don't get into like crazy jackpots like I used to. Like, my wandering mind is not going to get me like a bag of cocaine sitting in the parking lot of a strip club. Like, that doesn't happen anymore. You know, like, I don't have those kinds of consequences. But the problem is the consequences are seemingly kind of not really a big deal, which actually reinforces the habit. See? And for me, it's like this kind of thing I call, it's the cheating at solitaire thing that we've used before. It's like, I'm not really practicing, but I'm sort of getting away with it. You know, no one's really pissed at me. My wife still loves me. My kids think I'm great. My dog thinks I'm spectacular. You know, like, I don't need to do shit. But the downside of that, and I think COVID has been the great vehicle for this, is in the midst of all that's gone on the last month, I've really had to come to terms with the fact that sometimes when I just sit quietly by myself, I don't really like what's going on so much. You know, that when my mind, that when the way that my mind behaves on pause, not so great. You know, a lot of stress, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of no faith, a lot of doubt, a lot of no faith in humanity. A lot, you know, so I'm having to actually work harder now because of all the times I didn't work hard over the last two decades. So I feel like I've been paying a kind of consequence for a lack of discipline that's gone on for, you know, very, very many, 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 many years. And maybe you're feeling that a little bit too. So it's a hard sort of practice to kind of do guided wise. So I'm going to do a practice that's really kind of what I would call a meta attention, not one T, but two T's. And that is really trying to pay attention to something that you have identified for yourself in your experience that's trustworthy, and just trying to stay with that, to be that, and to restrict the mind from wandering off into something else. So we'll do that here for some time. Let me grab my bells. And so probably a fairly, again, as usual, non-traditional practice here this morning. But actually, this was the actually beginning when I first learned metta, almost 30 years ago, when I actually, not when I first learned it, but when I first actually recognized that this might be not a bad idea. This was kind of the practice that I learned from Michelle McDonald, at IMS. So, somewhat traditional, but again, we're going to use our past. We're going to use retrospective awareness, wise reflection, you know, as remembering a time and a place in which this was really meaningful to you. So we'll do that here. So you can just kind of find a cozy way to sit. And we'll start and end with the bell. So beginning by finding your body form, sitting upright, comfortable in the privacy of your own domain, which might actually make you feel more comfortable knowing that you're in your home. And then just taking an inventory for what's going on right now in the mind. If there's any sense of doubt in the mind, worry in the mind, fear, concern, uncertainty. What's going on in the heart, feeling and emotion, whether you feel tired, exhausted, scared, content, apathetic. And just taking a few minutes to be as honest as you can with yourself about what's really going on. And allowing awareness to arise to see clearly. This faith practice, trustworthiness, is about seeing clearly the truth of this experience, the own truth of your mind and heart, as it's revealing itself to you right now. And as you continue to do this, allow your awareness and attention to settle at the heart center from the left shoulder, drawing a straight line across to the right shoulder. And just feeling the lifting and rising of the in-breath, the falling and dropping of the out-breath, this heart center field, letting your awareness reside. And as you stabilize your awareness in the body form, breathing, sound, sensation, temperature, gravity, whatever helps you stay put, and then engaging memory, and just seeing if you can, your memory can bring you back to a time when your practice felt very alive, very supported, a time when you felt inspired, perhaps when you felt, this is exactly what I need. This is what I need. This is going to work. And just see if you can recapture that experience as best you can right now. And if your mind wanders or strays off, just bring it back as much as you need to recapture this experience. It might have been something that you read or a talk that you heard, maybe going to a Dharma group or sitting on retreat. But just seeing if you can recapture a moment or moments when you really felt like this was exactly what you needed. It made sense in a way in which nothing had before. And let as much of that in as you can. And if you're able to recognize or access any degree of something that you could identify as trustworthy, a trustworthy sense of ease, presence, feeling of good enough, if you can just rest in that, just allow your attention to be immersed, allowing your awareness to just soak that right up. Soak it up like a dry sponge in a bucket of water. Doesn't matter how large or small the amount. But see if you can recognize the feeling or the sense of trustworthiness. And seeing if you can understand as clearly as you can that nothing outside of this direct experience is available right now. That it's virtually impossible for anything outside of this moment's experience to improve the quality of this experience. This is the great delusion that we face. And as you might find yourself being confronted by feelings of doubt or uncertainty, or the tug of the mind's wandering, just to remember that that is not trustworthy. There's nothing there for you that's going to be skillful or helpful. So when confronted with these mental states of confusion or worry or doubt, to not let them corrupt your sense of presence, of ease, confidence. And continuing to guard the mind from the thought that something about this experience isn't right, not doing it right, something that's bad or wrong needs to go away. Guarding the mind from that aversion. Guarding the mind from the urge to fix or improve the conditions, even ever so slightly. And then just revisiting the area of the body at the heart center from the left to the right shoulder, noticing if it feels more open, more soft, less constricted. And recognizing ways in which the body might be responding to the quality of awareness that you're cultivating. and for the last few minutes, practicing in silence, and to just practice whatever it is that you know is going to work right now. What works to allow yourself to maintain a sense of presence and ease, trustworthiness? All right, y'all, thank you for your practice, and I look forward to hearing some of your thoughts on this. So I'm going to shut off this recorder.